The following program is intended for a blind and print-impaired listening audience, and it comes to you courtesy of the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm John Federson, and my task today, as it is every week, when I can make it in, is to read the Indie Week, the Independent, and this issue is dated February the 6th of 2025. And I've said everything that's not the issue, and now I'm going to read the issue, and so here we go. First, from downtown Raleigh, thousands of peaceful protesters encircled the North Carolina State Capitol for hours Wednesday as part of a nationwide movement opposing President Donald Trump and his agenda. A sea of banners, signs, and slogans surrounded both the Capitol and legislative building, with demonstrators flying American, Mexican, and Canadian flags in protest of Trump. The event was part of the 50 protests, 50 states, one day rally movement that erupted across the U.S. Wednesday afternoon. Passing cars and trucks honked in support as protesters jeered Trump and his policies. North Carolinians marched counterclockwise around the Capitol and chanted in support of LGBTQ, reproductive rights, protection for immigrants, and in opposition to Project 2025, the conservative policy plan that has dominated headlines throughout the 24 presidential election. But perhaps even more vitriol was directed at billionaire Elon Musk, influential Trump advisor who heads up the newly initiated Department of Government Efficiency. Protesters chanted, "Deport Elon Musk. Elon Musk has got to go." And 1, 2, 3, 4, Elon Musk is out the door, to condemn the Tesla founder's growing influence in the administration. John Haika, a business consultant from Charlotte, took the train over to Raleigh with his teenage grandson. The pair said some of their biggest concerns about Trump and the current political climate revolved around Musk, immigration, and health care. They brought a sign denouncing Musk, as well as Trump's most controversial cabinet nominees, Tulsi Gabbard, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Kash Patel. Haika's grandparents immigrated to the U.S. from Poland in the early 1900s. He said he supports immigration reform, but not the mass deportations and ICE raids of the Trump administration. Haika is no stranger to protesting. His first time voting in a presidential election was in 1968, a year mirroring 2024, in the sense that the sitting Democratic president withdrew months before the election, and the Republican candidate eventually won. Haika said, "I rallied against the Vietnam War. I rallied for civil rights, and I'm teaching my grandson that you can speak out." At one point, a man dressed in traditional attire held up his fist and waved a Mexican flag in front of the Capitol. He was shortly joined by a man with an American flag, and the two stood in unity. Other protesters wore pink pussy hats and keffiyeh, and some wore more unique costumes, including an alien mask and a Spider-Man costume. As the protest began, one demonstrator could be heard strumming his guitar and singing Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. Jennifer Griffith of Durham, Wade Daniel of Franklinton, veterans of the U.S. Army and Navy respectively met at the protest and found they shared similar concerns. In particular, they said they felt outraged about Musk's role, as well as Trump's suggestions of sending American troops abroad, including to occupy Gaza. The protest was unique in its decentralized nature. Flyers and QR codes circulated across social media websites, including Reddit, Blue Sky, and TikTok, and soon organizers took it upon themselves to form more detailed plans over group text and messaging apps like Discord and Signal. While groups like the ACLU helped watch over the protest, it was sparked by anonymous social media users spreading general posters calling to come together at, quote, your state capital. That lack of official involvement gave pause to some would-be protesters, including Griffith, who said she feared, quote, this was going to be a trap, before a friend reassured her that some local organizations would be joining in the protest. Caitlin Offenty, who wore an orange reflector vest and started chants through a bullhorn, said she was with the people of America when asked what organization she was part of. She said, this is inspiring. This is what America is about. The people are stronger than billionaires. Kenneth Humphrey, 85, who had served twice as Carteret County Democratic Party chair, said, quote, this is 1776 again. Every person who sees this has to know democracy is going to live. These Trumpers, these MAGAs, I regard them as villains. We will outlast them. All right, now here's, we'll get local right away now. Of course, that was local, but this is about St. Augustine's University, which we've been reading about for several weeks now. They rejected a lower interest loan contingent on the board chair's resignation, starts the headline, after St. Aug's University entered into a multi-million dollar loan agreement with a 26% interest rate. The Self-Help Credit Union's CEO offered the embattled HBCU a loan at a significantly lower interest rate of 9%, documents obtained by Indy and the Assembly show. However, Self-Help's $19.5 million loan offer also came with one big stipulation. Two SAU board members, including its current chair, would have to resign from the Board of Trustees. The CEO, Martin Eakes, wrote, this is not personal. When a team or business collapses, the coaches are asked to leave to restore the confidence that the future course of action will be different from the past course of action. This financing offer came several months after St. Aug's entered into a credit agreement worth up to $30 million with Gothic Ventures, a venture capital firm. An initial $7 million loan carried the 26% interest rate and listed the main campus and 40 other pieces of property as collateral, prompting public concerns from Eakes, alumni, and community groups who have described the loan as usurious, predatory, and a, quote, land grab. In response to the Gothic Ventures loan, Eakes offered the university a 10-year loan that included $7.5 million to purchase the Gothic Ventures loan, plus any interest accrued, money to negotiate a payoff of the outstanding IRS liens, and an additional $3 million for the university to use as needed. On top of Gothic Ventures, the university does owe about $9 million in unpaid taxes to the IRS, which has placed liens on its property. SAU owes millions more to other creditors and recently slashed its budget and workforce by half in order to shore up its finances. In December, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, SACSCOC, I'll call them SACSOC, voted to revoke SAU's accreditation, citing the institution for 7 violations of its finance and governing standards. SAU remains accredited pending an appeal hearing in February this month. Among the requirements listed for the loan, Eakes said the financing would be conditioned on the resignation of both Brian Boulware, the current board chair, and James Perry, the former board chair. The loan proposal said Self-Help would help would, quote, suggest but not require that Boulware and Perry be replaced by 2 individuals to make the strongest case to the SACSOC for continued accreditation. Eakes proposed that John Wilson, former president of Morehouse College and director of the HBCU initiative under the Obama administration, and Michael Curry, a retired bishop of the Episcopal Church of America, take over as interim chair and vice chair. Curry previously served on the university's board for over a decade. In response to a request for comment, an SAU spokesperson pointed to the previous statement Boulware made that self-help, quote, didn't really have an appetite for financially assisting the university. The university did not respond to a question about why it turned down Eek's proposal in November. Self-Help, a credit union founded in North Carolina, specializes in lending to nonprofits, small business, and low-wealth borrowers with an eye toward advancing economic equality for marginalized communities. Eek's also leads Self-Help's affiliate organization, the Center for Responsible Lending, which advocates for fair lending policies and battles predatory lenders. Between the IRS liens and Gothic Ventures loans, Eeks wrote in his loan proposal that the HBCU was on a crash course and the two debts would make it, quote, nearly impossible for the university to carry on normal business operations. He wrote in the proposal, I understand that this level of financing does not resolve all of SAU's accumulated debt. We believe that total financing of $40 million or more will be needed, including the amounts committed above, to meet that goal. In addition to Boulware's and Perry's resignation, the loan proposal also required the university to list all, quote, real estate and personal property as collateral, with Self-Help retaining the right to approve the sale of land. Any revenue collected from significant sales, which the agreement defines as over $1 million, would be shared in a negotiated ratio with the university to pay down any debts to Self-Help, continue operations, and increase the university's endowment. Eeks confirmed to Indy and the Assembly that he made the proposal in early November with an expiration date of November 15th. In an interview, Eek says he wrote the loan proposal at Boulware's request. In a sweeping press release titled Setting the Record Straight, sent to media on Tuesday, the university wrote that it had made, quote, numerous attempts to work with Self-Help between February and July of last year. Attempts, it said, went, quote, unanswered and showed a, quote, lack of willingness from the credit union to help the university. The university also said Eeks was motivated to put forth a loan proposal after, quote, realizing the then commercial certified appraised value of SAU's property exceeds $207 million. Eeks confirmed Self-Help was in conversation with the university in early 2024, but no loan application was ever submitted. He added that he made his November offer to SAU only as a last resort, after urging Gothic Ventures to lower its interest rate. Kip Johnson, managing partner of Gothic Ventures, previously had told the Assembly when concerns about the loan arose that he was open to negotiating the terms if the university was interested. Johnson did not respond to a request for comment for this story. The university said Eeks made his proposal in partnership with Jim Goodman, the CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company, which owns WRAL, the Durham Bulls, and the American Tobacco Campus in Durham. In an interview, Goodman denied this, saying while he was aware of the loan proposal, he had, quote, nothing to do with that offer. He added, though, that he agreed with Eek's efforts in general to curb predatory lending. The university also said in its Tuesday press release that Goodman and other leaders from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, a Raleigh-based charity organization, quote, pushed for a merger, unquote, of St. Augustine's and Shaw University, where previously discussed the meeting in a letter responding to a lawsuit filed by an alumni group, Save SAU, that sought to remove the current board of trustees. That lawsuit, dismissed in November due to a lack of standing, alleged that the board, quote, breached their fiduciary duties to SAU by eliminating dissenting voices from the board and improperly awarding university contracts without due diligence or board approval. Goodman confirmed that the meeting happened, but says he and the other Fletcher Foundation members simply offered to finance a study to examine whether a merger in some form of Shaw and St. Augustine's would work. And he added that the offer is still on the table. As a business person, Goodman says, I think they should consider everything. An SAU spokesperson says the university stands by its previous characterization of its meeting with Goodman. Mary Beth Gassman, a professor at Rutgers University who studies HBCUs, has served on the board of several historically black institutions, including St. Augustine's University from 2011 to 14. In an interview, Gassman told Indy and the Assembly that self-help's condition, asking SAU's current and previous chairs to resign, is unusual, but she said that it seems fair in the circumstances. Gassman says, I think the lender has the right to say that because the board hasn't been successful. I'm not used to hearing that, but it's the lender's money to give. Felicia Commodore, an associate professor of education policy at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, who studies HBCUs and board governance, says part of a board's duty to the institution is exercising fiduciary responsibility and loyalty, which requires board members to put the needs of the institution above their own. In that context, Commodore says the board's rejection of self-help's offer raises questions about whether the board is upholding its duty of loyalty by choosing not to pursue the lower interest rate, despite the leadership stipulations. However, Commodore says it is also understandable the board may be uncomfortable with an outside entity telling them how to run their institution, especially given its history and relationship with the Raleigh area as an HBCU. And Commodore says it does become a tricky kind of situation where, yes, this may help us solve our problem financially, our fiscal problem, or at least help. But does it then create or open up another door where we find ourselves vulnerable to outside entities being able to control our institution? I don't think there is an easy answer. All right, over to Durham now. The Durham City Council has unanimously rejected the Moriah Ridge development. This article was just printed in yesterday's or today's issue. Over Indy Week, Durham City Council voted unanimously against a proposal that sought to bring around 1,000 new housing units to an area outside the city's urban growth boundary. Following significant community opposition that included hundreds of petition signatures and Say No signs posted near the site of the project known as Moriah Ridge. The proposal from Raleigh developer M.I. Holmes would have annexed 15 parcels totaling 168 acres between Irwin Road and Mount Moriah Road, as reported previously by Indy. The development marks a test of Durham's commitment to contain sprawl, coming just months after the city updated its comprehensive plan to focus on infill development within existing boundaries. The Monday night vote was 5-0, with council members Chelsea Cook and Didriana Freeman having excused absences. More than 20 residents spoke during the hour-long public comment period, all in opposition to this project. Several commenters identified themselves as residents whose properties would become donut holes. It's a phrase for county parcels completely surrounded by city land if the development moved forward. Wanda Roden said, I can't be annexed to the city. I can't afford it. She added she's lived in her home for over 50 years. I can't afford additional city taxes. I can't afford to pay for city water. I'm on a fixed income. Kelly McGregor, another resident whose property would become a donut hole, said she was shocked to learn about the proposed development, saying, "We couldn't have dreamed that this area, which was zoned for one dwelling per 2.5 acres, would be annexed into Durham City and be surrounded by development with 1,000 units. We're not against development, but we are against poor practice, lack of sensitivity to community, plans pushed through on legislative technicalities, and developments that are contrary to Durham's well-researched and comprehensive growth plan." Neil Ghosh, a lawyer with Morningstar Law Group, who represented Moriah Ridge, said the proximity to New Hope Commons and other amenities makes the land appropriate for development because it borders urban landscape. Ghosh said these properties are not within Chapel Hill's rural buffer, which basically means they're in Chapel Hill's UGB. They just use a different term. And let's face the facts, any area that's a stone's throw away from Walmart ought to be within the UGB. But council members cited Durham's urban growth boundary as a key factor in their decision to deny the annexation request. Council member Nate Baker says the comprehensive plan took almost 5 years to put together. It was very thought out. It exists. It's there. We have a delineation. This case is pretty simple. It's outside of that delineation. Baker added he would welcome a collaborative process with Orange County to envision the area's future development, but such planning has not yet taken place. Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton drew an analogy to national territorial expansion in his remarks, saying, "When we devised the urban growth boundary, a case that dealt with the urban growth boundary did not result in a net growth of Durham. The calculus was the county shrunk, the city footprint grew, but our map didn't change." This case is a little different because it's almost like we've met our Greenland or our Canada. Does Durham as a whole get bigger? That's a different discussion because it wasn't contemplated. While joining his colleagues in opposition, Middleton cautioned against premature celebration. He said, "Don't think that this is over and make this victory lap muted, because what we could have put our own hands on here and contoured for us may very well be dictated to us by other forces, and it may be less desirable than what we could have gotten while it remained here before us tonight." Councilmember Carl Rist said, "While the area's proximity to future transit corridors could make it suitable for development eventually, he wasn't ready to breach the recently established boundary," saying, "I can envision a day sometime in the future where we as a community decide to extend the urban growth boundary, but I'm not prepared to right now." That Moriah Ridge development would have entailed up to 1,000 residential units, including apartments, townhouses, and single-family homes, with 50 affordable housing units and up to 2,500 square feet of office space. And now, from Durham, batter up! Have your say on the future of the iconic Durham Athletic Park. The future of DAP, one of Durham's most famous historic landmarks, former home to the Durham Bulls and the backdrop to the movie Bull Durham, is up in the air. On 5.5 acres of, quote, rapidly developing area, the current use of this space as a baseball field is underutilized, according to the city of Durham, which wants to hear from residents about how this land can be used in the future to better serve Durham residents. The city's website notes feedback from this effort will be used to develop a concept that will benefit the community, tie in with adjacent open spaces, and create a more accessible and vibrant use of the facility. A survey open through the end of this month is an early step in the city's equitable community engagement process. Freshman counselor Carl Rist has his own history with baseball and the DAP. He played one season of collegiate baseball at Davidson College and picked the sport back up later in life when he joined a men's league that played games at the old Bulls Park. Rist, like many Durham residents, sees DAP as one of the city's iconic brands alongside Duke University. DAP is a uniquely famous sports facility for non-major professional sports team. And that stadium, of course, played this prominent role in the 1988 movie Bull Durham. The Bulls themselves played their last game at DAP in 1994. A new stadium, the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, opened on Blackwell Street for its first game in 1995. Rist says, how do we wrestle with how to improve this prime space downtown that has lots of growth around it and make sure it's more accessible to the public? Importantly, the survey notes the city is not interested in selling the land or using it for a private purpose, like condos. The survey reads, open space is lacking in the urban center of Durham, and this space shall remain accessible to the public. Construction in the area has surged in recent years. Apartments are being built across Washington, and the DIY district is in the midst of a dramatic makeover with the addition of Gear House and other new residential buildings. Full Stream Brewery, one of the anchor tenants of the neighborhood for over a decade, recently moved after wrestling with construction disruptions for years. Durham Athletic Park is not the only downtown site in need of a facelift. City leadership is already looking at making big changes with the Durham Convention Center. A consultant expects that new center to cost north of $500 million. The survey is up until February 28th. City staff plan to host a number of feedback sessions, which you can register for on the city's website. Now, I'm always, as an ex-symphony musician for my employment and history, I'm always pleased to hear something about classical music, no matter where it is. And, of course, the Durham Symphony Orchestra features there. In fact, one of my old bosses, Maestro William Henry Curry, has been their music director for quite a while. Well, the new Durham Symphony Orchestra program is a tribute to grief, resilience, and the last words of the unarmed, is this article. And it was just released on the newspaper Indie Week today. In 2003, though, Maestro William Curry was in the process of assembling a program for the Indianapolis Symphony. Curry remembers, a friend of a friend told me about a young African-American musical genius who just finished an orchestral work. Well, Curry looked at the composition, Herman Whitfield III's Scherzo No. 2 in E minor, and immediately sensed he was in the presence of a, quote, intriguing and extremely original talent. He selected the piece for his program. It received a standing ovation. Curry became a mentor to Whitfield, who was only 20 at the time, and they remained in close contact for several years, before eventually falling out of touch. In 2022, Curry received an email from Whitfield's parents. The young composer had died in police custody, they informed him, while suffering from a mental health crisis. They had called for an ambulance, but got law enforcement instead. Whitfield was unarmed. Whitfield's story, a tragically familiar archetype in contemporary American life, is one of the many that animates voices of the unarmed, justice, love, resilience. The Durham Symphony Orchestra's Valentine's Day program. The free concert, which will take place on February 14th, in the middle of Black History Month, is anchored by three works. Whitfield's own Overture Fanfare in D major, which will have its world premiere. Joel Thompson's Seven Last Words of the Unarmed, for orchestra and chorus, and Maestro Curry's only Eulogy for a Dream. The latter two compositions set existing words to music, though to vastly different emotional ends. Thompson's piece, at turns haunting, tender, and furious, draws from the last words spoken by seven unarmed black men who were killed by police, with the exception of Trayvon Martin, who was shot by George Zimmerman, coordinator of his neighborhood watch. Curry's composition, meanwhile, excerpts various writings and speeches by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and is uniformly rousing. An important component of the Voices of the Unarmed program will take place without any musical accompaniment. The symphony has planned a series of community conversations as a way to explore the ideas raised by this concert, which range from political exigencies like police reform to such weighty and difficult to define concepts as love and justice in greater depth. A planned forum with the composers and Whitfield's parents, who will attend the performance as special guests, will bring together local organizations like the Religious Coalition for Nonviolent Durham, Restorative Justice Durham, and Durham Community Safety's HEART program, which provides the kind of non-police crisis response that might have saved the life of Herman Whitfield. Preceding the concert, Curry and Thompson, who is visiting from Texas, where he is currently the Houston Grand Opera's composer in residence, will meet with students and teachers in Durham Public Schools. A panel discussion at the end of the night will give audience members the opportunity to engage with the composers. Curry says, "This program is meant to be about listening. To the music, yes, and also to the stories that inhabit it." When the orchestra premieres Whitfield's Overture Fanfare in D major, for example, it will be impossible to forget that less than 2 months ago, an Indianapolis jury found the officers involved in Whitfield's death not guilty on all charges. Even though the coroner's office ruled Whitfield's death a homicide, defense lawyers argued that health issues, the composer's enlarged heart, not excessive police force, were at fault. Whitfield was heard on body camera footage saying, "I can't breathe," while officers held him in a prone restraint. It's impossible, upon hearing Whitfield's story, not to think of Eric Garner, whose death, under similar circumstances in 2014, and the subsequent failure of a grand jury to indict the officer who placed Garner in a chokehold, led to nationwide protest. In fact, it was Garner's killing in 2014 that compelled Joel Thompson to compose Seven Last Words of the Unarmed, which will be performed after the overture. Thompson says he wrote the piece as kind of a journal entry, a way to process and give musical form to, quote, "the sense of worthlessness that I felt in the wake of the lack of indictment in the Eric Garner case, the lack of justice in all those cases." In composing the piece, Thompson reached back to Haydn's Seven Last Words of Christ as a structural template. He also borrowed an 18th century French Burgundian motif, "The armed man should be feared," to great effect. Each of Thompson's movements corresponds to one of Haydn's, except the last words of Jesus have been replaced by the last words of, amongst others, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, and Amadou Diallo. Where Haydn's Christ says, "I'm thirsty," for example, Thompson conjures the anguished last words of Oscar Grant, "You shot me." Thompson says, "I feel like every black artist that addresses the scourge of police brutality or the proximity of death in black life always has in the back of their mind that this can be me." to be on the same program as a fellow black composer who was murdered, he continues, is that voice in the back of your head made real. Thompson nevertheless hopes that his composition, for all of its unflinching representations of tragedy, would bring healing and understanding. He says, every time this piece is performed, I learn something about myself, about my society, my community. I see people, even if it's for a brief second, their hearts open. And I really hope the Durham community can see the life that was robbed when they bear witness to Whitfield's creation. Ben Haas, director of the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham, holds on to a similar kind of hope. He tells Indy that, quote, violence is a very distancing, traumatizing reality, but that in any community, even in one that's being torn apart, there are people singing songs. Voices of the Unarmed concludes with William Henry Currie's Eulogy for a Dream, which is right for the occasion. Like Dr. King's speeches from which his text is drawn, the piece manages immense gravity without sinking in despair. The music stirs and soars, as befits the civil rights icon. The connection to Dr. King in Eulogy for a Dream is more than textual. The impetus for Currie's composition actually came from Coretta Scott King, who suggested that he set her husband's words to music when she and Currie met in 1985. History looms large for Currie, who has been the Durham Symphony's maestro since 2009. He counts Lincoln across among his greatest heroes and is prone to quoting him in conversation. He says, we must be critical thinkers and critical rememberers about the problems of democracy. What can we learn from people that have been given these burdens that seem to be unendurable? Voices of the Unarmed reminds us we disregard the past at our peril. Currie's father was born a mere 50 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. He remembers at the age of 10 encountering those two drinking fountains on a family trip to Virginia, white, colored. We can't make sense of Herman Whitfield's death without this history in mind. Eulogy for a Dream ends with a line from Dr. King's most famous speech. It articulates precisely what Currie and Thompson hope voices of the unarmed might achieve. Quote, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. And since Indy has begun providing weekly What to Do This Week excerpts from available calendars of things to do, I will read it for this week. And this is around the triangle. So, Jamel Bouye, Futures for American Democracy, is at the Brian Reynolds Industries Theater tonight. February 6th at 8 p.m., Brian Center, Reynolds Industry Theater in Durham. And in a moment of profound national crisis, could a topic be more relevant? Is there a future for American democracy? In this Duke University event, popular New York Times columnist Jamel Bouye will speak on the, quote, historic nature, impact, and implications of this election and its outcome. In a typical column, Bouye, who is based in Charlottesville and also hosts the podcast Unclear and Present Danger, fleshes out current events with historical context, a kind of analysis that feels especially urgent right now. For a preview of how Bouye feels about the election, here are some recent column titles. Trump doesn't get to decide what the Constitution means. Don't fall for Trump's DEI dodge. This event is free and open to the public, and it's, again, February the 6th, 8 p.m., Bryan Center, Reynolds Industry Theater. It's on the Duke campus. Well, February the 7th, 8 p.m., Sluice with Chessa Rich, excuse me. That's at 8 p.m. at the Pinhook in Durham. In a 2024 indie profile of Durham musician Justin Morris, who plays music as Sluice, Tasso Hartzog wrote that Morris' songs, rich with memory and close observation, are rooted in North Carolina's landscape, wry, laid back, and ponderous, with nature-laden lyrics that would not feel out of place in Farmer's Almanac. Morris's music has been compared to Bill Callahan, a nod that doesn't feel too far off. In this Pinhook show, Morris is joined by another musician, Chessa Rich. Her 2023 album, Deeper Sleeper, an indie favorite, is themed around sleeping, creativity, and the dream world. Through its lush, pop-inflected music is guaranteed to keep you enthralled and awake. So again, this is Friday night at the Pinhook in Durham, 8 p.m. Now, again, Friday night and Saturday, 7 p.m. in Raleigh at King's, The Great Cover-Up. It is by design difficult to blurb the event. One of Raleigh's wonderful annual traditions features local musicians covering the greats. But all cover acts, 15 in total this year, are kept a secret until the big concert reveal. Past band appearances have included Weezer, David Bowie, and Joy Division. So rest assured you're bound to encounter a favorite in the mix. The buy-in of local musicians who go all out with costumes and acting is big, making this a very fun event. Bonus, you have several opportunities to go. That's February 7th, 8th, and February 20th through 22nd. All proceeds go to local organizations, and beyond that, are they working to help people who are struggling? Another to hear. February 8th, 7 p.m. at the Cary Theater in Cary, Country Soul Songbook presents the Big Sing Civil Rights Songbook. Country Soul, a local organization led by musician Kamara Thomas, Charlie Lowry, and Kim Register, works to amplify the voices of underrepresented voices in country music, a signal boost that's essential in a genre that's been forcibly whitewashed. This weekend at the Grammys, Beyoncé did win Album of the Year for Cowboy Carter, her official foray into country music. Maybe those genre tides are slowly turning. The organization also works to revive and celebrate underrepresented music from historical canon more broadly, as with this, quote, evening of learning and singing songs from the civil rights movement. Songs from times of struggle remind us the fight for justice has been done before and is possible again. At this event, Thomas invites community members to join their voices together. And don't worry, there will be a short vocal warm-up and lesson beforehand. It's the Cary Theater over in Cary, 7 p.m. on February the 8th. So now to attend at various times at Murphy School Auditorium in downtown Raleigh, Paint Me This House of Love. This is at the Burning Coal Theater, premiering not one, but two plays this season. The first comedy, Paint Me This House of Love, will see a U.S. stage for the first time when Ali Goins, playing Jules, shows up at the door of his daughter, Cecilia, Monica Ho, who has been estranged from him for over two decades. As they embark on a home renovation project, wounds from the past inevitably surface in clever dialogue by the playwright Chelsea Woolley that crisscrosses years of hurt and misunderstanding. Valentine's Day is usually all about romantic relationships, But the process of repairing familiar relationships is every bit as raw and important. Keep an eye out for Burning Coal's regional premiere of Being Chaka, which follows Paint Me This House of Love with the March 13th opening date. And if you buy a bundle with tickets to both plays, Burning Coal is offering a steep discount. So if you look up Burning Coal Theater's website, you'll find what you need about various times and admission prices. It's a very small theater. I can't remember what the seating capacity is, but it's probably 100, maybe a bit less. So check that out. Yo!
Do you know what this beeping is?
I'm sorry?
Do you know what this beeping is?
It wouldn't be a...
Well, still some more Enduro. And let's visit to Brightleaf Square. That's a good idea. And the kitchen of After's Dessert Bar. There's a whiteboard with a neatly bulleted to-do list. And the first item reads, Ass Red Velvet. That abbreviation's meaning becomes clear as Stephen Kennedy, who owns After's with his wife, Lindsay, begins to punch circles from a large rectangle of cake and build them up layer by layer inside transparent acetate rings. Ass, it turns out, means assemble. It's the kind of playful shorthand that makes sense in a kitchen where a stone mortar and pestle is painted with a dog's face. The Kennedys brought After's to a cozy brick-walled space in Brightleaf Square in December. The location is a second act for the couple, who, from May 2020 to May of 22, operated the dessert shop from a Durham food hall stall. That venture ended when, like several other vendors, they opted not to renew their lease, citing untenable rent and management issues. The process of opening this Brightleaf space proved to be drawn out. After leaving the food hall, the couple faced months of negotiations over the lease. Construction delays and a back injury that sidelined Stephen pushed their planned opening further. Now, 2 months after opening their doors, they're finally finding their rhythm. After's is still in its soft opening phase. The coffee station isn't set up yet, and they're keeping limited hours, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Tuesday through Sunday. But even in this nascent stage, the space has a strong sense of itself. From the molded chocolates Stephen calls the mascots, rainbows, unicorns, robots, and dinosaurs, displayed under a cloche dome, to the vintage pharmacy artifacts that nod to his profession, or her profession, excuse me, as a psychiatric pharmacist. I ask Stephen, who handles everything in the kitchen while Lindsay manages the shop design and operating logistics, what he plans to do with the remnants of this red velvet sheet cake he's working on now, a lacy network of holes. He tells me He'll dehydrate the scraps into crunchy crumbs for a garnish. He says, referencing the venerated Chapel Hill diner's dollar bucket of fried chicken bones, with bits of meat still clinging to them, "Someday I would like to have something like Time Out's bucket of bones, but with cake scraps." Stephen's pastry career spans over two decades, with stints at some of the Triangle's most esteemed restaurants, including Bin 54, Pizzeria Toro, and the now-closed Cypress on the Hill, and Four Square, among others. His fine dining background shows in the precision of his work, but there's playful irreverence to his creations that keep them approachable. The menu at Afters is divided into befores and afters, a nod to the British term for desserts. Befores include gluten-free scones in flavor like cacio e pepe, and brown coffee cakes, caramel brownies, and chocolate crème. The chocolate chip cookies are a signature item. Small and square-shaped, they're studded with what the Kennedys call funks, house-made chocolate chips made by tempering Colombian chocolate and slicing it into pieces with a five-wheel pastry cutter. He says you can't really find high-quality chocolate chips. For those ordering something from the dessert case to enjoy on-site, there are three armchairs and five bar stools. Stephen plates desserts with added touches. The chocolate crème arrives with dehydrated raspberry sugar, delicate milk dots set with agar and shaved white chocolate. The caramel brownie gets a scattering of candied peanuts, and the coffee cake comes with a quenelle of Ceylon whipped cream. Lindsay, who still works full-time at UNC hospitals, arrived midway through my visit. She says, "I don't know if Steph told you, but I have a thing called time blindness." She's dressed in a yellow shirt, patterned scarf, and rectangular glasses with warm beige frames and a beaded strap. The historic walls and floors of Brightleaf Square hold particular significance for Lindsay, who grew up in Henderson and spent summers priming tobacco on her grandparents' farm. She remembers visiting the complex as a child in the 1980s, not long after it had been transformed from tobacco warehouses into mixed-use space. Lindsay chose durable design elements that honor the building's industrial roots, from Art Deco brackets that support the bar to antique French factory lights that hang overhead. Even the cans of milk she sourced from a Japanese grocery store in Cary reflect a commitment to sturdiness. They're metal so thick that you can't flex the can by pressing with your finger. She says, "I'm always trying to look for things that give that sturdy vibe." The theme extends to the broken Hobart mixer displayed prominently on the counter, a relic from their food hall days. Its paddle and dough hook attachments sit in the window, wrapped in artificial leaves and twinkling battery-powered lights. While the couple doesn't say this outright, it's hard not to see it as a symbol of resilience after their challenging start at the food hall. While many Durham businesses lean heavily on bull imagery, Afters pays homage to the city's less used nickname, the City of Medicine. The dessert case is actually a medication fridge salvaged from a Walgreens closing sale. From the same sale, the couple acquired cabinets with tall drawers that once held prescription bottles. While cleaning them out, Lindsay found two tablets, Xanax and Plavix, which she framed in ornate gold, like some owners might frame their first dollar bill. For near her, the pharmacy touches reflect both her present and past. Having grown up working in her father's pharmacy, she and Stephen hope Afters can provide their two children with the same experience that shaped her, learning the value of community connection and hard work in a family business. Between pointing out design elements and explaining her vision for the space, Lindsay keeps glancing at the dessert case. Her admiration for Stephen's dessert hasn't waned in their 15 years of marriage, she says. I'll watch him bake and think, okay, well, that makes sense. But then I'll taste it and wonder, when did you perform the spell on this? She's adamant about keeping the coffee program simple. No espresso drinks, just quality drip coffee. We can't turn this into a coffee place, she says. Then the desserts become an afterthought. Stephen interjects from the kitchen. Is she talking about fika yet? Earlier, he told me she would bring it up. Now, at his prompting, she explains the concept, a Swedish tradition of taking a break with coffee and a sweet treat. Lindsay says Swedish desserts aren't saccharine. They're balanced, not overwhelming. That's what we're going for. But in a culture where afternoon treat breaks are not ingrained, the challenge is making the concept stick. While I'm at afters, midday on a Thursday, a student wanders in explaining that her laptop blue screened out while she was working elsewhere in the building. The forced break had brought her to afters for a sweet treat. That's an inadvertent American version of fika, where dessert comes not from cultural tradition, but from technological failure. After's business models is divided into thirds: walk-in service, custom orders, and wholesale to restaurants. Stephen is currently supplying desserts to the Durham Hotel, and the couple plans to expand their wholesale operations in a space that seats only eight. Space for walk-in traffic is limited. The trade-off for visibility and seating at the food hall is a more intimate, curated experience here. As with any small business in 2025, they're still working out the kinks. Their partnership is a study in complementary skills. Lindsay says, I think maybe the core of our love for each other is that we both have to be well-versed in measurements and conversions. She calls Stephen over and starts quizzing him. How much does a large egg weigh? 54 grams. How about the yolk of a large egg? 20 grams. And Lindsay beams. She says, I sometimes like to call myself the joy bringer and Steve the joy maker. She grows sheepish, uncharacteristically. Maybe you should leave that out of the article. I feel we sound a little pretentious, like we're such good people. But the description fits. Stephen's desserts are meticulously crafted, and Lindsay's quirky touches make the space feel warm and intentional. In a rapidly changing Durham, where national chains and quick service concepts make it easy to put a fine point to a brand, an ice cream shop, a late-night cookie shop, Afters stands apart. A dessert shop that honors Durham's medical legacy. And I'm